Constitution of the state.
And that I will well.
That I will well.
And faithfully perform.
And faithfully perform.
The duties of board member.
Duties of board member.
Of the Planning and Land Development Regulation Board.
Of the Planning and Land Development Regulation Board.
Of the City of Palm Coast, Florida.
Of the City of Palm Coast, Florida.
On which I am about to enter, so help me God.
About to enter, so help me God.
Thank you. Congratulations.
I am Pete Lennox.
Sybil Lucas, how are you, Pete?
First, thanks for being here. Short notice. And congratulations to our two new members. And congratulations, Mr. Davis, Mr. Dolney, for reappointments. We have another new member that's not able to join us tonight. They were out of town, so they cannot make it. And Mr. Jones, Jim Jones, is another member that is on the planning board that can't make it tonight. So really appreciate the short notice of being here. Typically, Wednesdays are our regular scheduled meeting, but tomorrow night is a special hearing for City Council. So we wanted to try to get some of the training in for the planning board so we can go on for regular business. But if y'all, this is Katie Reichman, your attorney, who will be representing the planning board. My name is Ray Tyner. I'm the planning manager. I'm one of the staff, the liaisons for the board. Irene Schaefer is our planning clerk that you will coordinate with her and your agenda packages and a lot of your staff support. But before Katie's going to start with a presentation, maybe just briefly, if we can go and talk a little bit about yourself for our new members and your interest and just a little bit of an introduction so everyone kind of knows who you are. We have some new faces.
Sure. Sybil. Good evening and welcome and congratulations to you. My name is Sybil Dodson Lucas and I've been in Palm Coast since I guess we moved here in 2004 and coming down from New York City where I worked for three successive mayors in the mayor's office of construction as the director of community outreach and notification. And in that role, I was involved in bringing into the construction industry women and minorities in New York City. Prior to that, I worked with the Department of Environmental Protection and the Bureau of Water Supply, doing roadway construction management. And prior to that, I was trained and worked as a city planner in New York City. So one thing kind of led into the other. And when we came here, I was very interested in the infrastructure that was already in place and what was going to be happening here in Palm Coast. It's a lot different than working in an urban environment, but it's certainly interesting. So I bring some knowledge to it, but I'm also learning an awful lot from my colleagues here on the board. And again, welcome.
My name is Pete Lennertz. I moved here in 2012 and prior military, U.S. Navy. I worked for Northrop Grumman as a contractor for them, and I've been with them 26 years. I started my own business up here doing home inspections 2 years ago, and just interested in how Palm Coast is developing and looks like the way that it's going and the avenues that are happening and stuff, and just wanted to be more involved.
Hi, my name is Clint Smith. My background is in civil engineering. I originally came to Palm Coast right out of college in 1977. Worked for ITT for 18 years, then moved to a company called Lowe, who developed Grand Haven and part of the Ocean and the Ocean Hammock. And then spent 7 years with Syntex Homes, and the last 11 years I'm employed by Palm Coast Holdings, the developer of Town Center. My whole adult life has been spent in Palm Coast, and it's a great place to be, and I'm happy to be here.
My name's Chris Dolney. I moved from the Orlando area in 2011. I work as a real estate appraiser for commercial and some residential. I'm a regional scope, so I service a wide geographic area, not too much here on Palm Coast, but in many other municipalities.
My name is Glenn Davis. I'm presently, we moved here in 2003 from the state of Virginia. My background is traffic engineering, along with many other talents that too numerous to mention. I'm happy that we've got members, new members, or people that are willing to serve on the board, because it's our city, and we represent a lot of people, and it's a very interesting board and very interesting thing. So I'm glad you're all here.
Thank you, Glenn. And I'm Ray Tyner, planning manager. I started with my background is environmental, actually. I worked for the private sector, environmental consulting, and I was a manager for a mining company. I was their environmental safety manager for titanium mine, actually, before I came to the city as a reverse environmental planner. And I've been here since 2002. It's a great city. I live here. I got a 2-year-old daughter now, and want to raise her in this beautiful city. Glad to have y'all as part of our team.
I'm Katie Reichman, and I represent several cities as city attorney, and then I'm fortunate enough to work with Palm Coast. I started working with Palm Coast back when it was first incorporated, and then Bill and I, my husband's the city attorney, he left the firm. We left the firm that we were with at the time, and we're fortunate enough then to be hired by Palm Coast subsequently with our new law firm, which is a multi, we work in many counties in the state. Our law firm represents many cities and school districts, and we just love working with Palm Coast. The people are just so engaged, and the staff is great. So I'm very happy to be here.
I'm Irene Schaefer. I have moved to Palm Coast full time in December of 2008. Prior to that, I worked for 30 years in the cable television industry, customer service, and IT most recently. And I got a job with the city in 2010 with Parks and Recreation, where I worked for 4 years as a part-time facility clerk. And I applied for a job with Mr. Tyner for planning senior staff assistant, and I was hired. And so I'm here since October 2014. I really enjoy the planning board. Learned quite a bit.
And our first role of business would be to elect a chair and a vice chair. Anybody wants to nominate anybody? I know I've been doing this for the planning board since 2002, involved with it, and this is kind of the first time that we pretty much have a new board. So, and our vice chair, who's not here, but our chairman is no longer on the planning board as of this meeting too. So our first order of business would be to kind of vote for a chair and a vice chair. So, yes, ma'am.
If it's appropriate at this time, I'd like to recommend and propose Mr. Beebe as the new chair of this board.
Who?
Mr. Davis. I'm sorry. Mr. Davis. As the new chair of this board. If you need a rationale as to why.
Okay. I would like to recommend Mr. Jones. He served as vice chair since I've been on this planning board, and I think it just makes sense for it to flow up and the vice chair be replaced, only because he's more familiar with the operations and methodologies that need to be used. I understand that he's not here, however, that makes more functional sense.
You know, it's a great point. Mr. Jones is still on the board and was having an excuse absent today. We can wait while we have our full board to vote on a chair and a vice chair. Mr. Davis, would you like to do that?
Whatever.
It's up to y'all. I mean, but it is an option. I would ask Katie if that was an option.
Yeah, absolutely. Since we don't have any pressing business tonight, I think we could safely wait until the next meeting.
Does my recommendation stand?
Absolutely.
Or my nomination stand?
Yes, yes.
Through to the next meeting, then fine.
If you don't mind just repeating it at the next meeting, just for the sake of...
Not at all. Not at all.
Is that the consensus then? Everybody's good with that? Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Davis.
Do you have the clicker?
Yeah, I am...
So you're going to put my sunshine wall? Oh, he's putting it.
Where is the...
Always looking for PowerPoint.
Where, no, I'm looking for the arrow. Where's the arrow?
So I gave you all packets, and many of you have, that are already on the board, have seen a lot of this information before.
Thank you.
One is the PowerPoint that you're about to see, which is about the strictest law in practically all of the United States, the Florida Government and the Sunshine Law. And then the other is a big packet that has a lot of articles. There is quite a bit of repetition in there on quasi-judicial and such as that. But I apologize for that. It's something I've put together over the years, so I've never really tried to consolidate it 100%. But there's a lot of good information in there. Normally we have tabs on it, but we tried to get it all together quickly because I just came back from vacation. So sorry about that. But starting in on the PowerPoint, as I say, this is the strictest in the country. And it's counterintuitive in a lot of ways because what the law says is not what the law means. It just says that you can't have two or more members of the same board discuss matters which will foreseeably come before them. But it actually applies to any... It doesn't have to be a matter that is coming up for a vote. It could be something that foreseeably might come before you. And it basically means you can't gather together, you can't talk on the phone, you can't email. And this is obviously something all the sitting board members are well aware of through conduits or through Facebook, through any means. You can't, two of you communicate on an item that might come before you. So it requires basically these three things that seem simple but are not always so simple because the interpretation is inconsistent with the plain wording. There doesn't have to be a meeting. There doesn't have to be a quorum. There doesn't have to be official acts despite the way that the law is written. Even speaking casually with another board member can be a violation. And I should add that people have been indicted for just being seen out together when there's a controversial matter. We've been fortunate here in Palm Coast that we haven't had many controversial matters. But if there's a controversial matter, there might be people looking for any indication that they can raise a question as to whether there was a Sunshine Law violation. So it is a good practice, really, based on, believe it or not, based on the case law. The best practice would be for you to not talk to fellow board members at all outside of this meeting if you want to 100% be protected. I know that sounds totally ridiculous, but that is what we're coming to in this state of Florida because of what some of the cases have said. So this is how it could be worded. Any communication whatsoever has to take place in the public if it relates to something that might come before you. All right, so everybody has to vote, and no one's ever been prosecuted in the state for not voting. So you can tell there that if you feel you have a legitimate reason not to vote, you're probably not going to be prosecuted for abstaining. But the exceptions that we have in the state are when there is a financial conflict of interest, when some vote inures to your monetary benefit or loss, or your business partner, or your close family members. And that would mean that you would have to file something with Irene within 15 days that says why you abstained. But there's a new statute out, and I'm not sure that the sitting board members are fully aware that there is now this new statute which allows you to abstain from voting where you feel that you might have a bias when it's a quasi-judicial matter. So that's helpful. And what does it mean to be perceived or to feel yourself that you have a bias? When you come into this hearing room, you're supposed to have blinders on, and you come in like this, and you don't know anything about the matter until you get here. And you're supposed to be like a judge would be in a trial, so that if someone is charged with murder, the judge is not going to go around knocking on doors, asking all the neighbors what they think about you. If I'm charged with murder, I wouldn't want the judge to do a lot of outside investigation before they heard the evidence, right? Same thing with all of you. It has to do with basic fairness and due process. But it's taken to extremes in Florida, like the Sunshine Law. So oftentimes, if you have an opinion on a general subject and you express it in the press or something, like, I don't like cash for gold businesses, or that's not even good because that's specific. I mean, I don't like businesses that check cashing. You could potentially, if there was a check cashing business in front of you, be alleged to be biased. Certainly, if you, as a Palm Coast resident, you're going to be aware of what's going on in development, and you're probably going to be driving by sites that are going to come before you. Maybe you even know a site intimately, and the thing that you want to avoid is doing any investigation on your own, and even hopefully not getting out and walking a site. As helpful as that would be to you, and as against the grain it seems to say that you should not be intimately familiar with the site, you just feel like you're doing your homework, you're being a good, you know, board member. But what the way quasi-judicial proceedings are set up, it's set up for you to come in here tabula rasa, and basically you're learning everything for the very first time. So within your power, if you can manage to come in with an open mind and a basically not having any knowledge, that's the best thing for purposes of ensuring a legal proceeding. So you can sometimes attend by phone if you have a valid excuse. It's a very narrow exception. This is not of interest to you, the place of the meeting, because we always have it here. We always have to have a open vote. If people want to come in and record the meetings, they can, or they take videos. So the meetings that staff has are usually not required to be open to the public. That would be a difficult way to do business if staff was constantly having to have public meetings for every little thing they did. But there are times when a staff meeting can be required to be sunshine open to the public, when it's like the Development Review Committee and they're making a decision. Do we always have to have an item on an agenda in order to take action? Well, no, not always, but sometimes your procedural rules require it. I don't think we got rid of the procedural rules, right? So we don't have any procedural rules, but what about the public's right to speak? We haven't had a problem here at Planning Board with having an overwhelming number of people speaking in a while, But with quasi-judicial matters, which, and I should explain for purposes of, I think Clint's very familiar with the term, but Pete, for you, a quasi-judicial matter means that it's something like a rezoning of one lot or conditional use special exception variance, these kinds of things where you have one owner coming in and asking for a particular development approval that requires you to take the code and apply it to the facts of the particular matter. And so you are, in essence, reviewing evidence like a judge would. Well, what if you have 100 people here and you don't want to be here all night? You can limit the numbers that can speak to a certain extent, and not the numbers, but you can limit the time everybody has. You could say 3 minutes per person. But when it's quasi-judicial, you have to be very careful not to limit the applicant too much, or others that could be almost on the same footing as the applicant because maybe they live nearby and that sort of thing. There's also a new statute that's called the Right to Speak Act, and people call it a solution in search of a problem because really we didn't have a problem in the cities or the counties with letting people speak. I don't recall any meeting I've ever been at where somebody's been denied the right to speak, but whatever. The legislature thought we had been doing that. So now we say that the public has a right to be heard on all propositions before the board without defining what a proposition is. So generally, we just, the general rule is just let everybody speak on everything and allow input when in doubt. The sitting board members have seen this list of no's from the Attorney General. The Attorney General is famous for saying everything has to be in the sunshine. And this is really good, just reminder about not speaking to each other, not whispering to each other, not writing notes. Even if all you're doing is saying, I feel like I need to take a break now or something, it's still a perception thing, and it's good to get into the habit of not whispering or talking about votes. Here's the temptation. After the meeting's over, you think that a project is done. You're done with it. And so there's a temptation to sort of say, you know, just collegially with other board members, oh, you know, that was a great project. I really thought it was good. Well, the problem is that these things have a way of continuing on, as we all know on the board here, that you often see a project again that you didn't expect to see, or maybe there was some kind of hiccup or whatever. There can be any number of reasons why something gets appealed and then it comes back. So it's best to really refrain from talking about anything after the meeting other than how are the kids. So these are the sanctions, and that's why it's real important to, you don't want to be in the orange jumpsuit. Although I think there's only been one person that's been jailed in the state, but several people. But if there's a violation, then whatever action you took is void. And there was just someone who responded to an email about interview dates for district board applicants, and that person was charged with violation. And oftentimes it's an innocent kind of a thing. So what are other types of violations? What if you really feel strongly that a project is bad? You want to let your other board members know that beforehand. Well, if it's quasi-judicial, that's going to be a no-no. You can't do that because you've got to appear to be unbiased when you hear the matter in front of the board. But let's say it's a ordinance coming before you, and it's to reduce setbacks for all the houses. Everybody wants to go to zero setback or something. What if you just want to tell all the board members how you feel beforehand because you really feel strongly? Well, the problem with that is that in itself is not a violation, but the temptation is for somebody to reply to you, and then it's a violation. So the best thing is not to email board members, period. So you can read this at your leisure. And as I say at the bottom there, just being seen speaking together can be a problem. I'm sorry about that, but it's the way things are. So I just wanted to briefly touch on public records, because sometimes you might have a citizen or a developer email you, and maybe it's to your home email, and you don't want to have any possibility of that home computer being seized. Let's say we have a controversial matter. This sounds far-fetched, but it certainly happened to a lot of elected officials and some subsidiary board members, where they have to have their computer seized and gone through by a judge because there's an accusation that they have records on their home computer relating to city business. So if you get an email on your home computer, first of all, don't send emails regarding city business from your home computer if you can help it. It's best to use the phone. But if you need to contact staff or whatever, you know, that's fine, because Irene will have a copy of it. Always copy Irene on things, and that way you know she's got it. But bottom line is that the public has a constitutional right to see any city record, and that means anything relating to city business. If you have a doubt about it, it's probably a public record. So,
Katie?
Yes, Clint.
If you get an email from the public about something that's coming before the board, what do you do about that?
I'll defer to Irene, but generally we advise everyone to just simply send it on to Irene.
Okay.
I would advise, if it's a quasi-judicial matter, that you simply state to them, "I'm sorry, I'm not allowed to comment on this." That is probably your best policy. Then you don't have to stress about it.
And copy it, and then we can keep it as part of the record.
They'll keep it.
Don't keep it? Or they'll keep it?
They'll keep it.
Okay.
And you can delete it. What the best thing for you to be able to do is to say under oath, if heaven forbid that this would ever happen, but in the far-fetched possibility that you would actually get accused of having things on your home computer, if you can state under oath, "Everything that I ever had from the city business, I copied the city on it," then you're golden. They're probably not going to touch your computer.
Okay.
Yeah, because nobody wants, obviously, their business emails, you know. Now, understand that the Supreme Court has said that you yourself can go through your emails and eliminate from public view all those that are personal. So they have said, just because you're on a board doesn't mean the public has a right to rummage through your life. So we do have a few things like that, but some safeguards for you. But understand that anybody can ask for records. They don't have to have a good motive. They can be a stalker stalking you, and they can have been convicted of stalking, and they can ask for a public record every day on what did Clint Smith, email today. And if it has to do with the city, then we have to provide it to them. So, there's no objection that something's overbroad. There's no objection that it's anonymous. There's all these email requests coming in that just say, "I want these records," and that's all they say. And unless it is clearly spam, you have to provide, you not being you, but the city has to provide it. So it's crazy broad. And just because you provide the records, that doesn't moot the lawsuit. The people can still get their attorney's fees. And believe it or not, I don't know if you've read in the papers that there's a cottage industry of people going around requesting records. They don't have any interest in the records whatsoever. It's all about trying to catch people. And it's, you know what it's about? It's about money, like everything else, the root of all evil. They're trying to bring the lawsuit against the city and then settle with the city for a pile of money. and they never care to see the record. So this is serious stuff, and until there's some reform by the legislature, this is what we're stuck with. As we say, even texts can be public records. There was a thing called TextGate in Orange County, where Orange County commissioners were texting and they weren't able to retrieve those texts. So when in doubt, I say give to the city clerk. I think in this case it would be the planning board clerk. And we have all these penalties, the main penalty being that the city has to pay the attorney's fees of the requester, even if it's simply because there was a delay in providing the records. Gulfstream is a town in southeast Florida that has paid over $1 million fielding requests from this person that has no interest in the records, and their tax rate has increased over 42%. They have had to rob from their hurricane funds to pay for this, which is a complete and total joke, because this group that's requesting the records doesn't care what they get.
I got another question. As I understand it, even your personal notes that you make are public records if it's during the meeting on whatever your material is. So what do you do about that?
Well, if you write notes on your agenda, it's a close call whether that's a public record, because you can write notes to yourself, meaning that you only want to use them for yourself. You're not going to take them to Ray and show them. You're not going to show them to anybody else. Technically, that's your own record. That's not a public record.
Okay.
But that becomes a little bit of a dicey issue when you write it on the agenda, and maybe you're recording something that's relevant to the meeting. Possibly someone could get hold of that, so it's best not to put anything on there that you don't want on the front page. Probably, you know, try to keep that to.
So, for example, whenever staff is going through the presentation and an applicant speaks or the public speaks, and we write down questions to ask staff and or the applicant, that's going to be considered our personal notes if it's written in a binder not associated with what staff gives us, correct?
Yeah, it's really not so much where it's written. It's the law is all about what the intention is. If the intention is that you are never going to show it to anybody, then you can be pretty comfortable that that is not a public record. But I can't tell you that with absolute certainty, but the fact of the matter is it's going to be a rare day that someone asks for the notes of a planning board member. You know, that's the good thing. If we get a super controversial, but you know, the reason I say these things is because you just have to get in certain habits, right? And that way, when the controversial matter comes along, it won't be a big scramble and we're all trying to, well, here's what we need to do now. Well, let's just get into the habit. Because we have to live with this. Whether you like it or not, it is absolutely a big deal in Florida. So we've all got to adjust. Now, I don't have a PowerPoint for speaking briefly to you about quasi-judicial matters, but I did want to just, we've already talked about it to a certain extent. If you look in your big packet, it starts off on the first page talking about the kinds of decisions that can be made in the local government, which include executive, legislative, quasi-judicial, and ministerial. Ministerial being, you know, who's going to be chairman, legislative being an ordinance that comes before you that relates citywide or area-wide. Quasi-judicial being something where an applicant is requesting a variance for a fence setback. There's a list of what's legislative down at the bottom. The original enactment of the big zoning code, comprehensive plan amendments. And what is quasi-judicial is on page 2, lot-specific rezonings, variances, special exceptions, those kinds of things. So with quasi-judicial, the applicant and the objectors are entitled to due process on page two there, meaning notice and a hearing. And generally, that includes, when you say hearing, that means you get the right to cross-examine witnesses, see the evidence that is being presented to the board, which is where the whole idea of you all coming in here with an open mind and not having done any investigation beforehand comes in. And then page three, what's required for the quasi-judicial hearing, there's a couple of things that I wanted to emphasize about this, especially to our new members, and I think, Clint, you're well aware of this, that when you have this whole room filled and you look out there and there are a lot of angry people, well, that's not how you make your decision, right? You make your decision on the code and on the evidence that's presented. A lot of times, your only expert testimony will be your staff. And so you're having to listen to all these angry citizens, which fortunately we haven't had that in a long, long time, but you're having to listen to all these people getting up and saying, I hate this, this is terrible, this is horrible for our city. And you're sort of having to weed through that and see if that citizen is presenting anything that you can consider evidence. Because a lot of times they're expressing their opinion, but it's not in the nature of something that they can opine on. In other words, all of us know sort of in our gut what is pretty to us, what is aesthetically pleasing. And you can get any citizen up and they can be, if you will, an expert on that. Like, I don't think the look of that is good. Or I don't think that that's compatible with residential, if it's a, I don't know, bed and breakfast trying to go in the middle of a neighborhood. So those kinds of things, a citizen can express an opinion, but if a citizen gets up and says, this is going to create way too much traffic, as much as we may agree with that, that's not evidence. So that, because that person is not a traffic engineer, a lot of people say traffic engineers are not experts either, but that's kind of what we have to look to, is who is an expert in this area that can give us evidence. Now, if you don't feel that you're hearing enough evidence, you can always make that point. I need more evidence. Mr. Tyner, what did the traffic engineer say? What did our stormwater engineer say? Maybe you want to ask for a delay in the vote because you didn't hear enough from the experts. That's always your option. But it's very, very difficult for you as a board member to sit up there and have to make a decision despite the fact that you might have a very, let's say you have a very happy group out here that wants the thing, or a very angry group. Whichever way, you have to sort of weed through what they're saying. The other idea, as we discussed, is what about if a developer wants to talk to you before the meeting, or a citizen wants to talk to you before the meeting. I would advise you to tell them that your attorney has advised that you abstain from that, that you avoid that, and that you would love to talk to them, but that could they please express their opinion at the meeting. That's the best way. Now, if you do have contact with someone, you do need to disclose that. And arguably, that will eliminate the problem of the bias that you may have experienced. But it's all arguable, so best idea is to avoid it. If you turn to page 8 in that first, the first little memo, there's a brief little outline there on public ethics. And I think Virginia is probably going to give you the ethics pamphlet from the Commission on Ethics. So basically, you just have to be careful about making sure that if a vote comes up that you think you might have some kind of financial interest in, even if it's, I don't know, you're a member of a church and the church's property is involved or something like that, you can always ask me about it. You can always call the Commission on Ethics. They can email you something and make sure you're protected and make sure you file your disclosure with Irene, and she'll help you with that. We'll help you through that. Your prohibited actions, basically, you can accept under $100 of gifts from someone who's not a lobbyist, but the best policy is not to accept a gift, because a lobbyist is basically anybody. That even means if you're at a raffle and something, you know, you win something, and it's probably better to avoid any issues with that. That doesn't include gifts from relatives, of course. You can still have Christmas. Okay, on quasi-judicial, I'm just going to take
Clint
a few
has
more
a
minutes.
Question.
Oh, I'm sorry, Clint.
Because this is important to me, but the conflict of interest, because it's going to come up for me, I know, sooner or later.
Yes.
And so what qualifies is that if my company sold a piece of property to somebody and has no further continuing interest in it and they come before the board, that's not a conflict, as I understand it. But if my company still had a mortgage on that property, that would be.
Well, it's not that clear cut, because it has to inure to your company's special pecuniary interest. So if your company is big enough, potentially you, well, it's not really how big your company is, it's really how much are you getting from that? How much are you gaining or losing? And so it's probably best on a case by case. But if you have any doubt, you're not going to be prosecuted because you abstain from voting, because you feel there might be some kind of.
But if I have a question, I can just, do I go through Ray, or can I just like email you, or?
The best way of all is to go through Ray.
Okay.
But yeah, anytime you have a question, and you know what? Let me just tell you this: if you have any doubt whatsoever, if I tell you you can vote, and let's say that wasn't such great advice, if you ask the Commission on Ethics, generally they'll get right back to you, and you can email them. And if you get an answer from them saying, yes, you can vote, then you are 100% solid. Whereas if you get it from me, I could be wrong. So we generally advise if it's something that we're really not sure on.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, so you are protected. You don't have to hang out there to dry. And anytime you have an issue with that, we'll get you the answer that you need.
And
for
Katie,
sure.
Question for me. If, let's say, Mr. Smith abstains, you know, that feels it's a conflict. He doesn't vote, but he could still participate in the discussion.
I believe that's the case. The elected officials... Actually, I think it's the other way around. I always have a hard time. There's one rule for elected officials and one rule for appointed officials. And I think it's the appointed officials that can participate. But I'll check that out, because I don't... That one I
always...
It
doesn't happen very often, but...
It doesn't happen enough to where...
Would that still be considered a conflict because of the fact that by that board member discussing it with the other board members, try to sway the board members?
Well, and I do recall now, it is that you can participate if you're an appointed. Well, the law allows it. I think sometimes you might want to consider whether you really want to do that, because, you know, there's maybe, it could be questioned. You know, question. I think always probably better if you have, let's say it's Clint's company, I think he probably wouldn't want to get up there and say, y'all, this is the greatest project ever. Obviously that would seem to be a little bit of an undue influence, maybe a misuse of his position. More of an ethical issue for him than for the rest of you. But I think maybe a misuse of his position might be where it becomes a problem. That's an ethics rule, that you're not to misuse your position for your own gain. The way that comes up often is if you have a card that says, I'm a planning board member, and you use that when you're trying to conduct business. So you're implying you're going to get in good with the city if you use me for your whatever you need.
Does that mean we should not have it posted on CV or resume?
Oh, no, 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 absolutely. No, this came up in the context of somebody who was a mayor of the city and used a card for their realtor business that said mayor, and basically, you know, here, use me as a realtor. And so, no, absolutely, you'd put it on your CV. Okay, so just, I don't want to see how much time has it been. I don't want to take too much more time because I know Ray wants to give you a little overview. But let's see, there's anything else. As far as what you can rely on in making your decision, you are obviously able to rely on everything that you hear other than, as I said, the citizen testimony that is in an area where an expert should be testifying, and you can certainly rely on your common sense. One issue that comes up a lot is, and I think I have a memo in here on a new law, and I don't have it tabbed, but it's in your packet. It's called the exaction rule, which is to the effect that you cannot ask of the applicant put something that goes beyond code without possibly making the city liable under the Burt Harris Act. And for you, Pete, the Burt Harris Act was enacted because generally developers could only sue for a taking of their property if a regulation deprived them of all use of their property. So they enacted this Burt Harris Act, which said if the city burdens your property with a particular ordinance, doesn't take it, all use of it, but burdens it, when you had an expectation of what you were going to do with it. Example being, we reduce the height. We say that you can no longer build anything over two stories in the city of Palm Coast. Well, I had an expectation that I could put up a 20-story condo. Now I can't. It may not be a complete taking of my property, but I'm burdened. So they adopted this thing called Burt Harris that allows me to sue the city and recover my damages. Well, just last year, there was something that said, if the city asks you to do something that goes beyond code, for example, could you add 20 more parking spaces for the condo? Because we, planning board, don't feel that the code is sufficient. It says 1.5 space per condo unit. We think that needs to be 3.5. So we're going to say, developer, would you voluntarily put in 20 more spaces? Asking that is not quite yet a violation. But if that was put in writing, if that became the order, the development order from this board, such that it went above code and you're requiring it of a developer, that developer has a cause of action for a illegal exaction. And that's brand new.
So, Katie, just as an example, I've got 100 irate residents who are speaking to the planning board saying that I'm adjacent to this road and the code allows for 80 feet height, but everyone in the audience is saying, hey, my residential home is next to it. You guys, this is out of character. It needs to be two stories.
Yeah.
And then they make a recommendation to approve subject to. It needs to be two stories. It
gets
a developer order. Then that's illegal.
And I should qualify, it has to be put in writing to be a cause of action by the developer, and it has to be an action that you have final approval on. You know, simply the fact that you recommend that to council doesn't make it a mandate. But although there are things you have final approval on, which I'm sure Ray will touch on. But yeah, whatever goes beyond code can become a cause of action for damages.
So one step further, let's say you've got a multifamily piece that's, let's say, 10 acres, and it's surrounded by single-family residential, and you have a plan to put up multifamily. All these surrounding neighbors come out and are against this, but your plan is legally permissible and meets all other applicable guidelines for development.
Right, if
there's nothing that can be done without it being an inverse take if it was denied. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean,
I get the diminished utility of it, but what I'm trying to wrap my head around is there has been cases where a developer or prospect of buyer wants to buy a piece, but all the surrounding neighbors, they don't want it. And even though it's zoned allowed for, let's say, a higher density of use, everybody else is against it. And yet, my question is even if it gets pushed forward, their residents can't really say anything. Is that correct?
Katie, can I add to that? Because I know it's an example. We have some property that is zoned multifamily, for example. True. And I believe, as a professional, that it's out of character with the neighborhood, but it is what it is. It's zoned. Okay? If we brought that to the planning board, and it's a real case, real life situation. It was in the Tanzas Woods. And it was multifamily. They brought in the site plan. Our staff recommendation was approval. Me, professionally, I thought it was inappropriate, out of character, and this and that. We brought it to the planning board. I can't remember what that was. City Council sets policy. City Council denied that application because sometimes in rare circumstances, I would think you'd rather have a judge say no than them, maybe, you know. But the planning board, you know, our role, your role, our role as staff, and your role is to help us make sure that we're consistent with the Land Development Code. And what happened after that case was done, the appropriate thing would be, if you felt that it's out of character, let's look at the Land Development Code. And that's exactly what we did in that circumstance, is we went back, we workshopped with the planning board, and we created regulations to try to protect the single-family neighborhood. So that's an avenue. Yeah, you got to follow the code, but if you know, part of your role, and I'll get into a little bit, is crafting Land Development Code regulations. And just like we did for the landscape, it's time to go back and take a look at the landscape code. And that's how you address those situations.
That's how you impact. You have a tremendous impact in how the code gets written. But once the code is written, then when someone comes in, you know, I mean, I don't mean to make this an absolute, because there's certainly ways that someone can be persuaded not to pursue a project. You know, there's so many obstacles often to a particular project that can be raised legitimately.
Right, but in that same scenario, irrespective of that project in the Tanzas Woods, by the city council denying it, now they've created increased burden on this developer to get his project pushed through, because now he has to pay for attorney's fees and get the judge to say overrule it. And that's kind of, isn't that city working against everything that's in this literature that states that you're supposed to do what the code says and blah, 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 et cetera, so to speak?
I mean, sometimes the city would rather take the risk. And it is really the council that is the one that is responsible for determining that, for deciding whether the city could potentially be subject to litigation. That's really more the council's role, because they're the ones that have to answer to the voters about the expenses of litigation and so forth. So if they're fully advised and they choose to do that, it's certainly an unusual move. I think it's probably, that's the only, you know, maybe once
very, very, very,
every
yes,
10 years, something like that happens. But And I think that now that the ground has changed a little bit under us with this new statute.
Right.
So, you know.
That was the statute.
Yeah, yeah.
What about the special exception process? I've seen, when you get a special exception, it's like, well, we're going to make up the rules as we go. But is that allowable if you're in a special exception?
Well.
Or maybe you could put a requirement on something that wouldn't normally be there, but it's because it's a special exception, you think it's appropriate?
There's not a lot of case law, believe it or not, on what is a reasonable condition to put on a special exception. It's just pretty open-ended. The part that's not open-ended is, can that use be a special exception? It's either allowed or it's not. You can't go back and rewrite the code and decide, let's say, bed and breakfasts are special exceptions in residential. You can't say no to a bed and breakfast because you don't like the use. It's there. It's a permitted use subject to conditions. So you have to devise the appropriate conditions, and maybe as a result of that, they aren't able to go in because you realize the particular parcel is just not suited for it. I guess that's what I'm kind of getting at with the multifamily. Often the parcel maybe isn't suited for it, and that becomes clear if they speak to staff and go through the details.
Yeah, one good example, I would say, we do not do a whole lot of special exceptions, but one good example, Clint, was a kennel, not a kennel, but a dog. A veterinary clinic, and they had dogs that they wanted to board, and it was a special exception. I think was kind of making this up. It was like it's either neighborhood or COM2. Commercial 2, where it required a special exception. And the only requirement that the planning board had put as a condition, which I thought was very appropriate, was, buffering the neighborhood to the back, because there was houses. Like in your COM3 district or your industrial 1 or what have you, you're not going to have residents there. In this particular case, they had residents next to them. They happily added some additional buffer to help the sound and couldn't have the dogs out all night long barking, that type of stuff.
That's what I've seen most of the time is, hey, we want to increase the buffer or whatever it is, or we want to require a fence. Yeah. I mean, that's not a Bert Harris type thing. That's
right.
If it's special exception, that's something that you can do.
That's something you can do, and the question of what is a reasonable condition has not been decided in the state.
Okay.
So a reasonable condition would not be if the lot is 50 feet wide, to say a 50-foot buffer. I mean, that's obvious.
Yeah.
But other than that, it's hard to tell. So anybody else have anything? Well, thanks so much for your attention. I appreciate the old, if you will, board members listening. It's always good for me to get a review of some of these crazy issues in our wonderful state.
And I know I don't want to throw your heads up too much, but I just want to go over a few things. It's your role as PLDRB, and Katie touched on a lot of it. We have a 7-member board. We have meetings every Wednesday, every third Wednesday of the month is our regularly scheduled planning board meetings that happen at 5:30. We do have special meetings at times. If we workshop like our land development code, I think we had 5 or 6 meetings straight going through line by line our chapter for our landscape code. And this year we are going to continue to work on revisions to our draft, and signs are next, Katie. So something that we need to do because of the Supreme Court decisions last year that we have to change our sign code. PLDRB members are appointed by the City Council to provide recommendations, and it's quasi-judicial boards that Katie had covered, similar to courts, your function. And one thing I wanted to mention too is the application didn't state it, but planning board members are also a member of our Citizens Advisory Task Force. It's an advisory group for our city CDBG housing program that we have, I guess. So meetings are typically 2 times a year. What we try to do for those meetings is to have them kind of coordinate with this meeting on the third Wednesday if we can, but sometimes it's separate, but that's only, you know, typically about 2 times a year. If you can make it, great. If not, it's pretty easy for us to get a quorum, but we would ask that you participate in that as well. You, by state statute, is designated as the, what they call the local planning agency. It's required by the state regulations. You prepare, cause to prepare the elements of the comprehensive plan. And I'll get into the comp plan just a little bit later, and you have a copy for our new members today for a comp plan. They're also designated as the Planning Land Development Regulation Board with Florida statute, and that has to do with our, you know, making sure that site plans or applications that come in are consistent with the comprehensive plan and amendments to the Land Development Code. You know, you all look at the technical matters. Is it compliance with our land development code? I will be your staff liaison. You'll see me here at all the meetings most of the time, and you know, all of us here today that we introduce ourselves. We are here to provide. We record the meeting for you. We provide the staff support. We take the minutes, we distribute the minutes, we make sure that all of our regulatory requirements for notices are taken care of. We create the agenda package for you. We try to supply all the background information that's needed for y'all to make a sound decision. We provide the technical analysis and administrative assistance, and we also provide a recommendation. Professional staff will do that. Recommend denial subject to certain conditions or recommend approval subject to conditions, and we will make that recommendation. Tier two, we call them tier two site plans, such as special exceptions, variances, master site plan developments, technical site plans. And what the tier two is, from any non-residential projects over 4,000 square feet to 100,000 square feet, or residential projects over 41 residential units, not to exceed 100 units, final action is by the planning board. Staff will make a recommendation, and planning board will make that final determination. And after that determination, we either provide the applicant a development order, which we call it, your permit development order, and or a denial development order that spells out why the application was denied. The tier three is anything over 100,000 square feet and projects over 100 residential units. City council makes those final determination with a recommendation from city staff and a recommendation from planning board to city council. That includes all of you know, your zoning map amendments, your comprehensive plan amendments, and, you know, DRIs and those type of things, major controlling site master plans. And I just, you know, some of our new members, Clint's pretty familiar with the comp plan, but basically Florida statutes require that each state, that every local government in Florida have a comprehensive plan, and basically ours was created in 2004 when our first comp plan was approved. We started the process in 2002. It was a very long process that involved all the community, and basically y'all have a copy of the comprehensive plan, and everyone today has a CD of the comp plan. And basically, it's the vision of the community. It's policies, objectives that are spelled out in the comprehensive plan. And it is a powerful document. Buildings have been torn down in the state of Florida because it did, you know, people challenged the decision and said it's inconsistent with the comp plan. Comp plan controls, comp plan supersedes the land development code. In a lot of cases, not a lot of cases, but what we were talking about with the land development code, that maybe the land development code allowed something to happen, like height. There may be some language in our comp plan that conflicts with that, that council or we could use to say, hey, look, it's inconsistent with the comp plan. The neighborhood is inconsistent with what they're proposing, and pull out comp plan policies to provide that level of that legislative action or that quasi-judicial action by using that legislative comp plan
bolster the record.
To bolster the record, you know, and we have done that before.
But if you had something that was inconsistent that was purposely put there, then you downzoned it somebody and you've limited their utility. That's the same thing as inverse take or that definition of that for Rogers.
Yeah, I guess my point, Chris, is that the comp plan supersedes and throughout the state, and we use that, and when you see our staff reports, you know, we don't go through the entire comp plan. We always provide examples, even on site plans. Every application you'll get, you'll see examples of comp plan policies where it's consistent. And that's to bolster the record. That's basically what staff is doing.
But I think what Chris is asking is if we put something in the comp plan, let's say all of a sudden we decide we hate six-story buildings, so we put something in there, only two-story buildings, that would provide a cause of action too. It's not like you're immune from suit because it's in the comp plan. I mean, that the comp plan can also create litigation.
All I ask is I see it in my practice.
Yeah.
And sure I get calls on it too. Yeah. And they don't know how to measure the diminished utility.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Because I'll have one attorney arguing on one side, and then here I am getting hammered from both sides.
Yep.
So I just wanted to make sure. It's more for my own knowledge as well.
Well, it's interesting, too, because a comp plan in itself is inconsistent. Because we have one section that says we want new development. We have another section that says we want to protect the environment. So, you know, you do have, you have inconsistencies internally and between the comp plan and the zoning code. That's just the nature of the world. I mean, so, you know, you can selectively use the comp plan to do almost anything you want. But that's what, you know, if you're working legitimately, you use the comp plan to bolster whatever seems to be the right decision.
And I think because we were a new city and there's so many citizens that were involved in creating our comp plan, it stayed a really powerful document for us. And the one thing I could say about city staff and our planning staff that's really, really important with the comp plan, and we've been consistent. Okay, consistency is the key, in my opinion, for the comp plan.
And I would say that this staff, more than any staff I've ever worked with, uses the comp plan as a living document and doesn't just shelve it. And there's a whole lot of staffs that just look at their zoning code. But this staff uses it. It's something that the citizens worked hard to put together, and they pull it out and apply it to every single action that comes up.
And this is just a little snippet, because with the comp plan, you have different elements, environmental, you know, future land use, utilities, you know, different elements in that comp plan. But then part of that comp plan, we have a future land use map. And basically this map is, what's the city going to look like 35 years from now? You know, what is your vision? It's a long range vision. Your comp plan is long range as well. And this is just an example. You can see not a whole lot of categories. You got one residential, you got institutional conservation, mixed use, not a whole lot. Then the land development code, and our new members have a copy of that code. And, you know, after the comp plan, then we created with the planning board is, and the the public for sure, to create the land development code that's consistent with our comprehensive plan. Because the comprehensive spelled out a lot of things, you know, the land development code shall do this, the land development code shall do that, and we met a lot of those objectives and those policies by creating the land development code. And I guess, you know, to really, you know, kind of weed down and, you know, to explain kind of what the comp plan is for the city of Palm Coast and how the community involvement with the comp plan and how it relates to our land development code is that go to Hialeah, Florida, okay? Hialeah, Florida, you've got industrial next to your residential. People love it there. People who live there, that's their vision. That's what they wanted. That's what their citizens wanted. Nothing wrong with it, okay? That's their comp plan. Go to Naples, Florida. That's a different character than Hialeah. You go to, you know, Daytona Beach. It's a different vision of what those communities want. And our comp plan created, you know, if you take a chance and look at some of those policies that were in there from 2004, you'll be amazed to see the progression, how that living comp plan was lived in the vision and the landscaping and those, the environmental, the parks, the open space, our trail system. It's all kind of entangled into our comp plan. And here's just an example from our land development code. We have zoning. You know, that's your zoning. And you can see a lot more different categories in our zoning. For example, you remember the flume map had residential, one category, and what can fit in residential. This is when you get down to the nitty-gritty for multifamily one, multifamily two, residential one, residential two, residential three, residential four. You have all these different categories that could fit within that comp plan category. It's just compare the broad area to your right, the zoning map to the left, all the different categories, and very broad on the future land use. And you will have, and we have had, future land use map designations that come in and they want to change the map because the map has to be consistent with the zoning. And a lot of times they'll go hand in hand when you have a future land use map change and a zoning change. Because let's say someone wanted to do industrial within the yellow. Well, you can. You know, that's future land use. You can change the map. Current planning, you know, just goes to show that, you know, we do subdivision plats, site plan, and master plans. All of that you will see in the future. And what I really want to kind of focus on here in the blue, that's kind of our current planning process. This is kind of what the planning board is focused on. Majority of the time, you know, development order for site plan, master plans, and we have a process that we follow with the applicants. You know, they submit to us, we review it, we do the technical review. We have 15 days, we give it back to them. We're very progressive and trying to speed up that process because time is money, and that was our direction from our city council, is to speed up the development, speed up the review process, make it streamlined, make it better for them. And to do this, we also have a team. This is very important because when we come to the planning board meeting, you will see me, you'll see Tatey, and you will see your planning clerk, and you will see a project manager, one of our planners. You will most likely see Ida, Jose, Bill Hoover, and one of our new planners, Damaris. Okay, those four is the face you'll see that's giving the staff report. These aren't the only people reviewing the plan. We have a whole team of technical experts. So when we bring that analysis to you, it's been vetted for months. It's been going through the process, making sure that it meets our land development code. Each one of our senior planners, Ida, Jose, and Bill, are certified planners, AICP. They keep their credentials up. They're kind of the project managers, the coordinator. then you have me, and then, you know, we have Chris Johnson, who's been with the utility for years. He knows the water and the wastewater system, along with Irma, and he has a little team back of him that are reviewing the site plans to make sure that they meet our specifications, our standards for the land development code. Denise Bevan is one of our environmental planners. She's been here looking at wetlands, uplands, floodplains. She's also a floodplain manager that she certified with the state for floodplain. We have a couple of those in the city, but she's looking at all the environmental aspects of the site. She has that tech, both from the private sector and from the public sector, making sure that it meets our environmental section of the code. Jerry Heidman is our senior building inspector. He is part of the team, the TRX team, that reviews the plan, making sure that he has a certification. He's a fire inspector as well, making sure that we are meeting all the requirements for the fire department and fire safety as far as the fire prevention code and the Florida building code when it comes to the site plan. Bill Butler is a certified landscape architect. He's looking at all the landscape plans to make sure we're meeting that part of the code, or the irrigation plans as well. Sean Costello is a professional engineer. He predominantly looks at traffic and transportation, traffic studies that we require, and goes through all those details to make sure that we're meeting concurrency, making sure we're meeting all those technical requirements of the code. We have a new engineer, Mike Peel, who has 25 plus years of engineering experience, part of our TRX team. That's also reviewing site plans from a technical engineering aspect. So as you can see, that's, you know, a lot of times you don't see these folks that are in back of us or right on the side of us when we come into these meetings. And when we provide you the technical data to say, you know, we are doing that work for you. We're trying to provide you all the technical support that we can, so you can make a sound decision. You know, this is just an example of kind of a typical process. We'll come in with a master plan. A lot of times, it's Cobblestone Village. Some of our older members may remember this, where they approved a master plan for Cobblestone Village. It was part of an NPD for this area. The next step is, a lot of times what we will do a subdivision plat based on that master plan and create different lots, 1, 2, 3, 4, you can see there where we created the lots, the technical standards. What we would do is make sure it meets those setbacks, make sure it's consistent with the master plan development that the planning board approved, make sure it meets all those requirements and regulations. And typically what we would do is go to city council, because city council as the approval for the plats. They would approve a plat, and then a site plan will come in. And then when the site plan comes in, we have all the different requirements of the land development code, elevations, and then our final product. And this is what, you know, the planning board would approve, you know, making sure it meets all of our dimensional requirements. This is kind of the end result. There's the master plan on the right that the planning board approved. Finished product on the left. Very, you know, it alters a little bit, but it's typical. We just want to throw this up. We've our planning staff and our technical review team, we've won lots of awards and stuff. We're very proud of. But that's basically my little presentation. I'm really excited. Any questions for me? I just want to give you a summary, and don't want to put too much in your head because it's already been over almost an hour and a half. So, any questions for us? Okay. Can I ask y'all something? Are y'all up for having a special meeting on? We've got a project. It's a master plan development project that we have been working with the applicant for some time, and it's actually in the Matanzas area, and it's a residential product that we are working on, and we're very close of having a final agreement with the applicant. They wanted to come to this meeting tonight and told them, well, we don't have a quorum and it's very inappropriate. We typically try to get the agenda package for you to read ahead of time by Thursday or Friday before that Wednesday. So I guess I was going to ask for the first date was the 5th?
October 5th.
October 5th for a meeting. I got to check with you too. It's for...
It's a Wednesday?
Yeah,
Wednesday.
It's a Wednesday.
5:30.
At 5:30. Just wanted to see if
y'all would be available. No meeting tomorrow?
No. That's why we're having no meeting tomorrow, because it's council's special meeting for the budget. Happens once a year. Last year, I don't think we had a meeting scheduled anyway for that month. But
how's the pipeline looking?
Huh?
How's the pipeline for projects looking on your end? For a while there, you had 3 or 4 projects coming through. I mean, has the pipeline shrunk or is it starting to fatten?
It's steady.
Is it?
Yeah, it's pretty steady. Things coming our way that we're working on. And also the code. We got the landscape code going to city council workshop. When is that, Clint? A couple weeks?
11th, I think.
11th. So we've got that going, and then Katie's been pushing me for the sign code, and we'll be bringing the sign code to you shortly, along with some other chapters that we'll be working with FCARD on. So we'll be hitting some rewrites of the land development code. Like I told you, landscape chapter, that was over, but we'll have some more of that coming too as well. But the only way, I'm asking, we have done special meetings and we try to, get them to the regular Wednesday, but with us not having quorum, and it's just, I've been here for 14 years and we've never had where we don't have a quorum because we don't know how many members we have for the regular scheduled meeting. So the applicant is asking to go on the 5th. So just I'm asking. Y'all be here? Quorum?
Some options. On these special meetings,
what's that?
If the board members are not available on these special meetings and we can't get a quorum.
If we don't have a quorum, then no.
Then the applicant would be notified that.
Yeah, if we don't have a quorum, we don't have a quorum. And they'll have to wait until the regular scheduled meeting. But we try to accommodate. Like I said, we haven't had a whole lot of special meetings, but sometimes it saves 2-3 weeks. Because it has to go to city council, and to wait a whole month sometimes is tough for some of the applicants. They have contract obligations. They're going through our process and working hard and doing a great job, but sometimes their private contractual obligations, they're pushing it sometimes, and I like to try to accommodate for them if we can. So we'll give you a holler. Irene, we'll call and confirm that we have a quorum, and we'll try to set something up on the 5th.
Irene's pretty good at that. It's just sometimes she falls asleep. But she's really good at that. For you new board members and everything, she's really good at finding out if you can or cannot. So if your phone doesn't ring off the hook and your email piling up, she's trying to find out where you're at. So.
Knock on the door.
Just because a developer would request one doesn't necessarily mean that we can grant him one, though.
No, but I will always ask.
Can't hurt.
Thank you.
Question: if the papers are theirs to take.
Yes, those are yours.
And the CD I gave to everybody.
Yes, that is.
And to the new members, the books that I gave you, the comp plan, you can take those. But everybody else leave their work agenda book.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, y'all. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.